Welcome, especially to our visiting retreatants and a returning retreatant. It's wonderful to see you again, Michelle. And all of the Nivasis and your shining third eyes lit up with the glory of your love of God. And to those on the love stream, wherever your bodies may be in this illusory morphogenic field, may you receive the tsunami of Shakti that will bring you into God consciousness as your permanent state of realization of your true self. So this is a retreat that has been entitled The Great Escape. And I inflicted its music on you in case you were wondering. You will have to be a master of your mind to get it out of your head, because it's one of those types of marching music that tends to keep marching even after you wish it was gone. I was reconsidering the movie. Last week, I think I told you it wasn't worth inflicting it on you because it was sound and fury signifying nothing. I have a change of heart about it, which came this morning when I was finally given the message of what I'm supposed to share with you in this retreat. I'm always the last to know, you know, and so when that came together, then I recognized, no, I have to show it to you after the retreat. You see, when I first evaluated it, it was in accordance with the nature of the plot. And the plot is, you know, it's a comic book in a way, and it's way too long and involved with claustrophobic details of this escape effort. And then it's anticlimactic at the end because most of them don't make it. They die, you know, they're executed, etc. And so I felt like at that plot level, it was a relatively pointless, a vanity affair more than anything. But then as I rethought it from the level of character, I realized, no, this is actually a very important film. Why? Because the producers somehow gathered every hero actor available in Hollywood in that period, and they're all in the film. And the film is, in a way, a paean to heroism and to the heroic attitude and the indomitable, invincible force that is fearless, unafraid of death, and that conquers even in death. And so in a certain postmodern way, it's expressing the same archetype as Christ crucified, whose heroism in speaking truth to the Pharisees and the Romans and all of those non-believers was not held back by fear, and therefore whose presence in the world remains as an immortal vibrational frequency that anyone can attune to and realize their own Christ self risen from their cross of suffering. And so in that sense, I think it's valuable, because the retreat, seminar, call it what you will, this weekend is about becoming a spiritual hero, because this is what is now required of us. And so I want to talk to you about what do we really mean by the great escape. You know, in Kali Yuga, formally, every major religion is offering to be a vehicle for the great escape. And of course, some will call it salvation, redemption, the rapture, Jivan Mukti, Videha Mukti, the Buddha nature, the ascension. Give it whatever term you prefer. But all of them are, they capture one's loyalty, if they do, because they promise that through their sadhana, their practices, their prayers, their rituals, their rites of passage, you will be able to reach the great escape. The problem is that all of the religions became taken over by ego consciousness and by clerical establishments that were terrified of people becoming liberated while alive, because it threatened their control, and their purpose was social control at that point, which is why the Romans who killed Christ then became the Roman Church and acted as if they were the proper representatives of Christ consciousness when they had tried to snuff it out. And so the prayers that you have to believe as a Christian, starting with the Jesus prayer that's so famous among the hesychasts, the Christian mystics, in which you have to repeat over and over again like a mantra, God have mercy on me, a sinner. You see? But as soon as you believe you are a sinner, you have lost the portal to the great escape. And now you must depend on some grace coming to you in the future. But escape can only be now, in the present, not in some future. The same thing with Islam, which means submission, submission to Allah. But what about union with Allah? The Sufis didn't want to submit to Allah. They wanted to become drunkenly intoxicated on the realization that they are nothing other than Allah. And for that reason, Sufis were burned at the stake and executed in many other ways, and finally had to go mostly underground, as they still are today, at least in the Islamic countries. And we can see the same patterns happening even in Buddhism, which is began at least much more as a liberative enterprise. But once the lamas took over, they made what should have been a path of instant enlightenment into a gradual path. But there's no time for a gradual path now. So we want the great escape now. And this is the purpose of the retreat. So what is the great escape? And what's the difference between the great escape and all the little escapes that the ego is much more interested in general? You know, I would even say that the ego is a program that is designed to keep one obsessed with little retreats, little escapes. escapes from the suffering of the ego mind. In an almost infinite number of ways of narcissistic jouissance. You know, some will abuse alcohol or drugs, and some will abuse the internet and social media and their phones, and some will run away by watching films. Others prefer to watch porn, and some will prefer to read detective novels, and some will play bridge, and some will play chess. And, you know, you can go on and on as to what people are interested in doing to run away from their real self into meaningless activities. Although they can become engrossed in, you know, being obsessed by juicy conspiracy theories and researching all kinds of strange and exotic things in the world that you can now reach via the internet. But the attainment of the real self, this is what is avoided at all costs by the ego. And an ashram is a place that's designed to minimize the opportunities for the small escapes and focus your attention on the great escape, which is why many egos devoted to the small escapes are very unhappy in an ashram and are constantly dreaming of being in a place where they have more opportunity for those small escapes that are so much fun and, of course, always lead to disappointment and despair, because wherever you are, the grass is always greener somewhere else. And, you know, the next escape is the one. The last one was disappointing, and et cetera, et cetera. So most people stay on that gerbil wheel of one small escape after the other, which never work, and avoid the confrontation with the necessity of making the great escape. Because the great escape is from the ego itself. So, we have to understand not only where we escape from, but where we escape to. And this is something where there is some controversy among different schools of thought. And I want us to go beyond all of that, because ultimately they're all in harmony, although they employ different signifiers. So the Advaita Vedantins will say, reach the Supreme Self, and the Buddhists will say, reach the no-self and the emptiness, whereas others will say, no, reach the fullness. And you have every sort of philosophical intonation. But all of them, when you analyze with luminous clarity what do the signifiers actually point to in the real, they are all pointing to the same thing. Because the ultimate real that you are cannot be adequately conceptualized by any term or set of terms or propositions or concepts or paradigms or any other way that you want to try to grasp the real. The self that you are, and make note of this, the self that you are is ungraspable. Okay? Until you grasp that, you will not be able to reach freedom. You will not be able to give up the desire to grasp, to attain, to gain, to reach liberation. And you can't ever reach it because it's not an it. It's your I, not another, not an object, not a God, not anything that you can objectify. And so the entire project of philosophical understanding fails, in the same way that the great mathematician Kurt Gödel discovered that every mathematical system fails. Every logical system reaches a point of failure where it cannot answer a question, or its answer is inconsistent and contradictory. And so until we develop a capacity for becoming connoisseurs of contradiction and paradox, and the realization of the inadequacy of language to represent the real, we will not be able to break through the veil that is produced by thought, which turns out to be the main obstacle to the great escape. Even though you have to think very clearly to get to the point where you can go beyond thought. So we have to know who is able to escape and exactly what we are escaping from and what is the secret of success and what cannot be escaped. So I propose that there are 10 forms of psychological bondage that we have to escape from, just for starters, so that you have a sense of what I'm talking about, especially if you're new to Sat Yoga, when I refer to ego consciousness, which is that tiny sliver of the mind that identifies with the body and identifies with the operating system of the body, which is a set of algorithms of repetitious thought patterns that were installed in infancy by the parents and the family system as you acquired language and developed further nuances, refinements, and subtle bondages as you internalize the family system and then the social system and then whatever religious system or ethical system or other system in which you became trapped ideologically. So we need freedom from all ideological beliefs, all beliefs. And of course, we often cherish our beliefs and we don't want to let them go. And so we have to look at our beliefs and see, is this really something that serves me by holding on to it, or does it create a bondage that prevents me from realizing my infinite nature? So the 10, I would say the first is fear. People run scared. And there's two kinds of fear, really. We have phobic fear and we have anxiety. The phobic is situational or focused on an object. I'm afraid of spiders, or I'm afraid of snakes, or I'm afraid of whatever, name it. But it's a specific thing that then you try to avoid, and you spend your life avoiding it, and then occasionally being horrified when you have to face it. But you orbit around a certain fear. And then there's anxiety, which is a fear that's so generalized that it has no object. It's just a fear of life, a fear of death, a fear of what could happen, a fear of what did happen, a fear of dreaming about what happened and what could happen, and the ensuing paranoid fantasies that bring about what you fear, since the world is a dream and a projection. The second is depression. And depression can be caused by self-hatred, because one was not loved in childhood, or one was abused, traumatized, neglected, abandoned, etc. And one can hate the world for having done that to you and be depressed because you can't open your heart and love anyone because you were too hurt and you will never allow that again. And so, of course, you're going to feel depressed because love is what it's all about. Anger is the third, and of course, anger can be based either on the frustration that you have at your inability to accomplish something, or it can be rage and fury at someone else for being an obstacle to your intentions, or having insulted you, or in some way challenged you and caused you to lose your poise and your sense of control of the territory. And then there is the bondage of pride, and pride here is hubris, the pride of the ego, which is based on an illusory superiority complex and on an illusion of control. So, and then, of course, the bondage of guilt, and that can be based on a real basis of behavior, of cheating, lying, or something else that your ethical system makes you feel guilty for. Or it can just be a sense of guilt that your birth and your existence was too much trouble for your mother and your father, and you're guilty for just being alive. And disturbing their life plans because you weren't planned, and your life interrupted their dreams of being a ballerina and a rock star or whatever it happened to be, right? So you can have a sense of guilt totally based on a fantasy like that. And then there's, of course, the really mean one, shame, which is the inferiority complex, and or a sense of unworthiness, unlovability. And then one of the most popular ones in the time of capitalistic intentionality is busyness. People love to stay busy, rajasic. And you can either be busy with routine things, oh, I've got to clean the house, I can't meditate, and I've got to, you know, walk the dog, and I've got to do this, and I've got to do that. I'm always too busy to realize the self. Or you're in a high-pressure situation where there's a time constraint and you have to solve a problem immediately and you're under stress and strain, and there's one problem after another that keeps you far too occupied with problem-solving for being able to escape from the problem that you are to yourself. Then, of course, there's the bondage of boredom, you know, and there are many people who live very boring lives, and they're bored with their lives because they're not fully alive. They're living at far less than their potential, and in states in which they have compromised and given up on their hero's journey because of security, money, some other attachment in which they have sacrificed their true heart's yearning for that great escape in order to take care of others and be a good girl or boy, etc. But then end up with very boring, meaningless lives. Even though they may be very comfortable, they produce a kind of quiet agony. And then there's the bondage of those who are spaced out and who prefer to be spaced out. And this is a personality strategy in a way, but it can become a constitutional way of being, that one is just always not really here, but not in a state of enlightenment or liberation, but just in a state of like an autistic retreat, a retreat into an inability to think, not a transcendence of thought, but a laziness of the mind that prefers to sleep or, you know, be drunk on something that will just cause you to black out or tune out through some mindless means. And and then there are the narcissistic enjoyments that are more positive, which is you can get fascinated by some new digital object, you know, that's available, or some toy of some kind, or some enjoyment of the desire of the other. Whatever it is, that fascination is temporary and will also lead to a dead end of boredom and of meaninglessness. But it at least creates a temporary stimulation and a release from boredom, but it doesn't release you very far. So it's a very tiny escape. How many people have gone through these 10 forms of bondage? And okay. Are you ready to let go of those now and be free for the great escape? Good, because none of those ways of living will serve you. And you'll ultimately regret it. And so this is the time to complete that hero's journey. Because what we want to escape from is the ego, but also in the ego there is the illusion of karma, suffering, other kinds of bondages that are created by the ego mind that keeps you earthbound and unable to conquer certain fears, like the fear of death and pain and loss and abandonment and isolation and loneliness, etc. They limit the creative intelligence that you can access. The ego mind is just a tiny sliver of your complete consciousness, and it has veiled its access to the unlimited self in order to be able to focus on the illusion of pseudo-agency of the ego that is dedicating its consciousness to the well-being of its body. to the health of its body, to the beauty of its body, to the status in society, to all of the other goals that we are indoctrinated into wanting to have as egos, and being successful, and finally trying to be loved and valued by your grandchildren or others in your life, so that you can redeem a sense of you having wasted most of your life. And so you try to externalize and connect with others in order to create certain effects that you're not able to actually transmit, because you haven't achieved yourself freedom from the ego, so you can't really offer it to anyone else yet. So, in the movie, they were in a prison camp of the Nazis, and they decided that the best way out that wouldn't be detected was tunneling out. And I think that's a good metaphor. And they made several tunnels, and the traditional approach to the Great Escape takes one of four tunnels. Okay. Now, my suggestion is you actually combine all of these in one much larger reality tunnel, but you can get through the barrier using any of these four tunnels. And the four, I suppose I should probably write them on the board. You want to do some writing on the board? You have a good handwriting. The first one is Krama, K-R-A-M-A. Krama we could translate as method, but this is the ancient Sanskrit word, and there was even a Krama school in Kashmir, a wisdom school. So this is method. You can get out by using a tried and true method. And some of the methods are very complicated, and they involve asanas and mudras and pranayamas and chanting of various kinds and other kinds of sadhana, kriyas, all kinds of activities. And it's based on action, on doing something that will change your state of consciousness. So in order to get out through that tunnel, you actually have to have a lot of willpower to keep going with that method, because any method will be gradual and will require endurance and a relentless stick-to-itiveness. And the problem for most egos is they have conflicting desires. And so, you know, you have people that... How many people have joined a gym, you know, and for the first month you went regularly every time and you were lifting the weights and following what the coach did, you know, and then one day you say, you know, today I'm just going to have a beer and pizza and skip the gym, but I'll go back, you know, but then somehow you don't go back as regularly, and soon, yeah, your membership is there, but you haven't been there, you know, in months, and right, the thing, it turns out to have been a waste of your money. You know, so how many people have had that kind of an experience? Okay, well, so any kind of sadhana that's based on a method, the odds are you're going to give up on the method before you reach the goal. And that the reason is you're starting out, when you use any method, you're starting out with the belief that you are a person in the world who is a bodily being who has to do bodily action in order to achieve a change in your consciousness. And there's a contradiction in that, because that's exactly the delusion that you want to overcome. And so your methodology is ratifying the very thing that you need to drop. Now, someone with very powerful will can actually get quite far using method, and some actually maybe make it. And I think in the old days, some actually did achieve chittavritti nirodha through a method, you know. And even Sri Ramana offers a method for those who want it, atma-vichara, which is a pretty simple method. It's about as simple as you can get. But even that, how many people really practice atma-vichara without a break until they have broken through the ego and reach Atman consciousness? Almost never happens. It didn't happen in Ramana's lifetime very much. You know, one cow made it. And, maybe a few others. Murugana probably did, and a few others, but not too many. So, you know, method is probably not the tunnel I would choose as my first option. But if your mind tends to be very enmeshed in concrete thinking, that's what you want. How do I do it? What's the exact mantra? How do you pronounce it? You know, and, right? It's got to be exact. And, right? So all of these methods are, of course, they are small escapes that are delays. You know, you can with pranayama, you can get to a temporary kumbhaka where your breath stops for a fairly long period and your thoughts stop. You know, but then as soon as you get up and the thought and the breathing starts again, the thoughts start. You won't. I don't know anyone who's got liberated through pranayamas. Okay, however, it gives you a glimpse. It gives you a taste of, you know, what it's like to be in a peaceful consciousness for a few minutes. And some drugs can do that, and some other means. But again, it's temporary, and then you become dependent on whatever the prop is that you've used. I won't belabor that point anymore. The second is jnana, okay? Jnana is, I would translate it here as understanding. Understanding is a much more powerful approach, a much more direct tunnel. Because if you reach a high level of understanding, your mind will enter a state of luminous clarity. But in that state, what you will understand is that your real self cannot be understood. Okay? Understanding leads to its own subversion or its own proof that thought, symbolic capacity to grasp cannot work, cannot reach the ungraspable. You cannot stand under what is the actual foundation of your being. You cannot see the seer. You cannot know the knower as an object, as another. You cannot reify the self. You do not have two selves so that one can know the other. The self is, but it cannot know itself until its beingness has been fully self-revealed, okay? And that cannot be attained through symbolic understanding. That has to be transcended. But it will take you so far that you can grok that and then take the leap beyond the conceptual mind. So it has a value. The third one, In Sanskrit, I call it Vandana. Vandana. There's a famous activist named Vandana Shiva. Have you ever heard of her? Yeah, beautiful woman working for good in the world. Vandana means adoration. So her very name means adoration of Shiva. It's the state of such blissful love of God, such devotional surrender, that one enters a state of ecstatic bliss of union with that one that you adore. And then you become not one who adores another, an ego adoring God, or a soul. It has to be soul level, because the ego doesn't have adoration in its repertoire. Only the soul level of our consciousness can be in the fullness of adoration, because you have to be totally vulnerable and open for that. But you have to reach that point where the object of adoration drops away, and so does the subject who adores, and all that remains is adoration itself. That's the tunnel out, because you're in ecstatic, drunken, divine madness. And once you have entered that state, there's no nothing that can stop you from final liberation. So for those who are more feeling-centered than thinking-function-centered, adoration, if your heart is open and has love for God, it's a path that works. But again, it works only when that adoration has attained its non-dual nature. So it also tends to be gradual and incomplete, because the adoration is usually for one's concept of God, or one's image of God, or one's notion of an archetypal form that represents the goddess or the godhead in some way that can be held in the mind as an object. And that has to be dropped. You cannot make a graven image of the Supreme Lord, as all the Abrahamic religions do know. So the fourth one is pratyabhijna, pratyabhijna. And the gnya comes from jnana, but this is not the same. Pratyabhijna is recognition, immediate recognition. So if you see someone whom you hadn't seen in years before, but you have a sudden, I know you, a sudden recognition of yourself, of the self, of the fact that you are the self, that sudden recognition breaks through all barriers and requires no method, no concepts, no, not even love. You go immediately to bliss without having any need for a dualistic relationality. So those are the four tunnels. Tomorrow I'm going to propose a fifth one to you, but for tonight, I think that will probably suffice to get you beyond the perimeter of your prison camp, if you're still in the ego, and to the realization of what freedom could be. total freedom. Total freedom from suffering and from any frame of reference that limits you, any paradigm in which you are a victim or an extra or a being without the capacity to be God realized. If you have any of those false beliefs, you have to drop them, and immediate recognition is, of course, the most efficacious way. But what I'm recommending for tonight is that you consider combining all of these. Atmavichara, a method, a simple method, which is simply asking not verbally, but wondering, who am I, really? What do I mean by I? Because I know I don't really mean the body. I know I don't really mean the mind, because the thoughts arise by themselves. Sometimes I wish they weren't there and I can't stop them. So I know that the mind is not me. It's a program. It's a robot. It's a mental parasite that I have no control over. And the affects that the ego mind brings up. I can be happy one minute and depressed the next. I don't have control of my emotions at the ego level. Things can upset one very easily, or scare one, or bring one into a different mood. And one is not immune to those shifts. So you want to be completely free of being subjected to the disharmonies and incoherence of your own mind. So if you do atma-vichara and you do it with adoration, then it's much more powerful. If the I that I love is the supreme I, the I that is universal, not simply particular to this body apparatus, but the I am-ness, the great I am, then there can be instant adoration and devotion and surrender and yearning for union and love, joy. And this opens the mind to the understanding that God is infinite and there is nothing outside of God. Therefore, we are all within God right now. We cannot be anywhere but in the mind of God. That's the only place that there is. If you think you're living in a world outside of God, you're in a delusion. Because the world is an appearance within the mind of God. It's actually the goddess who creates the beauty of the world. This is the energy of God that configures the quantum wave functions and the qualium wave functions to produce all the life forms of the universe and all the forms that consciousness takes, whether mineral, vegetable, animal, or angel, or avatar, or whatever level of being, including the demonic and the asuric. All of it is an appearance within the mind of God. So we have never left our abode, our home, in the mind, which is also the heart of God consciousness. But we have identified with the dream that God is having in that mind, and with a character in that dream. And so we have lost our free will by playing out a character whose role is determined not by the will of the character's ego, but by the will of God. And only when there is no differential between my will and thy will, let thy will be done. When I surrender my will to that will of God, then paradoxically and miraculously, the power to change the nature of the role your character is playing in the world is granted. That's what grace is. You become the author of your life, not simply the character fictionally created by the desire of others and by causes and conditions in a world empty of essence, but you become the active intelligence of the playwright who can now fashion a role worthy of your true divine nature. And so it is this that constitutes the rebirth that you go through once you have gone through the rite of ego death. So we'll talk more about that tomorrow, but quantum physics has given us a very simple, easy way to understand the nature of bondage. Everything is information that is carried by waves. What kind of waves? And they're not waves that are made of matter. There is no such thing as matter. The physicists call them probability waves because they like to think that they know how probable it is that a wave function will collapse into a particle in this place or that place. And so they will say there's a probability of a certain observation being made at a certain time, but never certainty. Indeterminacy rules over cause and effect. But what is that wave really? It's a wave of consciousness, a mind wave, a wave of infinite potentiality. That's what the world is made of. And these waves contain information that is constitutive of the knowledge within the mind of God. And these waves can be collapsed by the mind of the goddess, whose function is to determine the forms that offer the most beauty and the most power, grace, and freedom for the forms of life that manifest in a divine world. And once you understand that there are two kinds of waves, the physicists only know the quantum wave function, and that determines the material objective characteristics of a thing or a body of some kind. But there's actually a double helix. It's congruent with the DNA molecule in the human. It's a helix created by a relationship between the quantum wave function and the qualium wave function. And this the physicists haven't yet grokked, but some are starting to. And what this function does is determine the qualities of your personality and of your character and of your repertoire of potential creative activity in the world. And if that qualium wave function is collapsed in a certain way that prevents you from feeling love, for example, or going beyond what is acceptable to the social other, or of in some other way fully individuating your potentiality, if the collapse of the qualium wave function is such that it creates limitations upon your curiosity, your intelligence, your ability to grow and develop and regain the full stature of your potency as pure spirit, then that qualium wave function, if you want the great escape, it must be decollapsed. That's what ego death is. It's simply that. Freeing yourself from an identity that is produced by certain attitudes and certain foci of intentionality to serve the body, to serve particular goals, others, and social activities, etc. So the freedom of consciousness can only be attained when that has been completely decollapsed and then modulated in such a way that it enables the complete creative freedom to manifest. Now, if one reaches a very high state that we call that of a siddha, traditionally there are four levels of stages of the journey. We have them here, but we haven't fully activated them because people haven't reached them all. The first is the pravartak, and that's the being who, it's a term from classical Indian theater. It means the when you first step on the stage in the first scene in which you are in the play. And so it's like a beginner, and here I am, but there's stage fright and performance anxiety, and there's all kinds of obstacles in the unknownness of being on a new stage of life. Of course, you can also say it's beginner's mind, which is the real Zen mind, if you have no anxiety about that position. So then you go from there to sadakhood. The sadak is the full disciple who is totally on it to complete the vows, to be in that state of total contentment, total nonviolence, total freedom of every kind of contraction and limitation, and in a state of surrender to God. All of the traditional yamas and niyamas. And then the third level is that of the siddha. And I haven't been able to name any siddhas yet here, but I'm hoping that we will soon have some. And the siddha is the one who has so internalized the freedom of the qualium wave function that it now begins to be able to have effects on the quantum wave function, on its and to decollapse aspects of that quantum wave function that appear as aspects of the objective world. Now, those mahasiddhas, for example, in Tibet, the famous ones who have achieved ending their body through spontaneous combustion or the rainbow body effect where, only the fingernails remain, everything else is gone. They have decollapsed the quantum wave function of the body itself. And that's the final achievement that can be done. at an individual level, but there's also a much larger quantum wave function on a cosmic level that needs to be dissolved. In any case, we'll talk more about that when we reach a point where that is relevant to the potency of our capacity that has been awakened and activated. And then the final state of the Swami, the one who has become the master of the self, the Swa. And there are usually three levels of Swamihood even that are spoken of. The first is the Nirvikalpa level, where you have achieved what Ramana refers to as mruta manas, dead mind. There is no more tendency for conceptualization or mental chatter of an ego kind. And then there is the nivritti level. And the nivritti is the wave of energy that is no longer going toward the world, but is going entirely toward the absolute self, toward the singularity, toward the point beyond the omega point, where a new world is born. It's like the womb of the next cosmic manifestation. And then the final level is the nirgun level, that level that is beyond all qualities, all describability, all conceivability, the absolute self. I won't say more about that now, but this is the goal of the Great Escape, and we are designed to succeed in achieving it. So there are no actual obstacles but your own ambivalence about this achievement. How many want to make the great escape? Yeah. Okay. So shall it be. All right, I think that's enough for tonight. There's a few minutes. I can open the floor if anyone has needs clarification about anything that was said or has some burning question to ask. Baruch.
Thank you for the teaching tonight, Shunya. And welcome to everyone who's joining us online. We have people tuning in from the Netherlands, Spain, the US, India, Germany, Costa Rica, Sweden, Ethiopia, Ireland, the UK, Australia, Canada, and Belgium. We're very happy that you're joining us for this retreat. Our first question comes from Nicole. Do the tunnels of escape pass through the quantum and qualium wave functions of your potential energy? Or is it all been freed by grace of God and you can bypass this energy?
Well, the tunnels can only be successfully made and traversed if the grace of God is with you. But because the truth is non-duality and the God whose grace you want is your real self, there is no obstacle to that grace guiding you in whatever paradigm you feel is possible and is called for by your own individual hero's journey. And everyone will feel called to a different tunnel or to a different way of combining these different approaches, but there is no real difference between the grace of God and the act of going through these tunnels. They are simply two ways of looking at the same phenomenon.
And then this one comes from Christina. If one truly escapes the ego constructs, weaving these four, perhaps five tunnels, entering fully into the kingdom of heaven with God, short of death or living at your ashram for life, how does one navigate this world full of deceptions, ego constructs like money, false prophets and toxicity, and maintaining their enlightened state in this physical world that is not set up to support such a great escape?
Yeah, but you see, you are projecting that the world you're dreaming that you're in now is the same world you'll be dreaming you're in when you're liberated and have gone through that tunnel. And it's not. You will see everything as perfect, and it will be perfect. You will recognize the divine beauty in everything. You will recognize the presence of God in everyone. And your very being and energy field will literally change the events that unfold, at least in your own local space. But if you are a Mahasiddha in a much larger sphere of effectiveness and care in which you function as a bodhisattva. And the more powerful you have become in that state of oneness with God, the more that you recognize that there actually is no world. It's all a projection, all a dream, and all of it can be changed in a moment. And as you transmit that energy to others, and a network of realized beings tends to manifest connected to you, the energy field grows ever more powerful, multiplied by these additional members of the network of consciousness that have become entangled at a qualium level and even at a quantum level. And as that happens, synchronicities multiply, miracles occur, events happen that could not have been predicted, and possibilities that only the mind of God could have come up with manifest. So be open to the miraculous, and you will discover that there are no obstacles. Is there anyone here with a question that you want to ask? Please go to the mic, okay?
Teachings. It's a personal question. I just wonder through which tunnel you escaped.
I didn't go through any of those.
Over the roof, over the wall?
Hmm?
You went over the roof, over the wall?
Yeah, you can fly over all of it, so there's no need. because you're not really in a prison. You're just imagining that you are. So the real great escape is to realize you've already escaped. There was never anyone in bondage who needed to escape. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, one more, Purusha, and then we'll call it a night.
Okay, from Aaron. Why is the character playing the game of the ego in the mind of God?
Well, if you didn't fall into a state of ignorance, you would not then be able to enjoy the bliss of God realization. You know, so you have to know the dark to really appreciate the beauty of the light. And so we want to know the full spectrum of possibility of consciousness, from the most divine to the most demonic. And so we create a world that has that full range of possibilities, and we fall into the most limited, helpless, hopeless, impossibly weak kind of being, only to realize with amazement, shock, and awe that we are actually the all-powerful God self. And that is such a wonderful release that then we say, you know, let's do it again. What a great escape joy that was, you know. So that's what keeps the whole cycle repeating. Because it's a perfect play, and the denouement, the deus ex machina, if you will, where you are the deus that comes out of the machina of the ego, is so glorious and rapturous that you say, yes, it was all worth it. And it was. All right, so I'll leave you on that note, and may you enjoy the bliss of liberation in advance, knowing that you're going to achieve it and that there's nothing better, and this is the ultimate happiness, and you're destined to achieve it. Give yourself the enjoyment of it now. Don't wait for dessert, you know. Have your enjoyment of liberation, since you really are liberated already. Start with the celebration of it, you know, then you don't actually need to do anything. That's my way. On that note, I will wish you all blessings for instant, blissful liberation from the illusion of every bondage. Namaste.